Good afternoon. Okay, well, thank you for coming today, especially the last session of the day. We're glad to see you here, and we're going to talk for a few minutes about against medical advice, and I promise we will get out of here a little bit early today. So I'm guessing that all of you have had some experience with against medical advice. Every emergency physician has, and it's a challenging situation for us. So we're going to talk today about some of the principles of allowing a patient to sign out against medical advice. We also have a couple of video clips that we're going to evaluate how this situation went in an against medical advice situation. So we're going to talk about some of the foundations of informed consent and refusal of care, how we can allow a patient to refuse care, how we determine capacity, and what we should do when a patient is refusing care. What can we do to protect the patient, to get them the best possible medical care, and to also protect ourselves if there should be some medical legal ramifications of the case. So let's start off with a case, and you probably have seen a case similar to this in your practice. We have a 76-year-old female who has end-stage COPD. She comes into the emergency department, dyspneic. Her pulse ox is reading 80%. And she appears awake and alert. She's conversing normally. She's aware of her circumstances. She can provide a history, but she is very short of breath. And she says, I've been intubated before. I don't want to be intubated. I would rather die. I've been in the ICU before. I refuse to be intubated. So the question comes up in a situation like this, if a patient deteriorates and becomes unresponsive, what should we do? Would we intubate? And I'm not going to ask you for a show of hands, but some people, if we did ask, probably some people in this room would say, yes, I would intubate because I'm not sure she's in her right state of mind. After all, she's hypoxic and in distress. She may not be thinking clearly. And others of us would say, well, she has the autonomy to make her own decisions about her own health care, and we should respect that. So we're going to talk about how we would further sort out a case like this and what are the important issues to consider. So patients who leave against medical advice, we know from our practice it happens about 2 to 3% of the ED patients that we see. It happens more commonly if you work in an inner city with disadvantaged patients. These patients, unfortunately, it would be great if we could say these are the healthy patients that are signing out against medical advice. But these patients have a higher risk of readmission. They have poorer outcomes and higher health care utilization in the future after signing out against medical advice. It's a big source of frustration and trust for patients, frustrating for physicians too. And unfortunately, also, there is some medical legal risk. About 1 in 300 patients who sign out against medical advice will come back to sue us, which seems totally backwards, but that's the world that we live in. So we're going to watch a couple of video clips today, and we're going to assess these against medical advice scenarios and assess what could have been done better about this scenario. So what we're watching for in this video clip is, did the physician do a good job of managing the patient who wished to leave AMA?
Everything looks okay.
No bleeding?
Nope.
Good, now I can go home.
You vomited blood. You fainted at work. The IV needs to stay in a while longer.
But you said I could leave if everything checked out.
Yes, but your potassium level's low. We need to replenish it.
Well, where'd you put the lab slip?
The printer's down. I got it off the computer.
You've wasted enough of my time already.
Nurse, get my clothes.
Whoa. What's wrong?
Nothing. Just a little dizzy from sitting up too fast.
Your pulse is weak, which means you're dehydrated. You can go after this fluid runs in.
All right. But that's it. Then I'm out of here.
Okay. Lydia, can you assist me in making sure all of Claire's discharge papers are in order?
Sure.
Her gag is absent. Her tooth enamels eroded. She's severely malnourished. She's anorectic and bulimic, and I don't want her leaving.
What can we do?
We'll get psych down here to put a hold on her.
Did you see my patient?
I'm just finishing the note.
Thank you.
Don't thank me yet. I'm removing the psych hold.
You can't be serious. This young woman's starving herself to death.
She might be, but I can't compel her to stay against her will. She has a job. She's not delusional, and she's not an immediate threat to herself or anybody else.
She could go into kidney failure, arrhythmia. What does it take for her to get treatment?
Her consent. Lots of people do bad things to themselves. They smoke, they drink, they eat fatty foods, and they drive without seatbelts, but we don't lock them up.
So we're supposed to stand by and do nothing?
Claire has the right to make her own decisions, even if they're bad ones.
Well, there's got to be something I can do.
If you can convince her to stay, I'll admit her to the psych ward. Otherwise, you'll have to discharge her after you've buffed her up.
I can't force her to stay, but I was hoping that she'd listen to you.
I love my daughter. I'd do anything to help her.
I'm sure you would. She's exhausted from not eating.
My God. She's skin and bones.
You told the mother.
I had no choice.
She's over 18.
She has a terrible disease. I had to do something.
Dr. Corday, we need you right now.
Want this IV out now.
Claire, please don't do this.
She won't listen to reason.
Claire, you're anorexic. You need to be hospitalized.
It's not what that shrink told me.
He said we couldn't force you to stay, but you could die without treatment.
Take this damn thing out!
All right. All right, Lydia, remove the IV.
I never said that you could call my mother. I'm an adult. I can do what I want.
You're right, you're right. I'm sorry. I was only trying to save you.
I don't want your help.
A friend of mine died today, fighting for his life. You want to leave? Fine. Kill yourself. You don't give a damn, neither do I. Discharge her.
All right, so I gather from your response that you think this was a less than optimal way of dealing with a patient who wanted to leave against medical advice. So when we think about this scenario, we saw the doctor did a couple of things right. The doctor truly did care about the patient, wanted to care for the patient, but there were some things that left, there was some actions left to be desired. For one thing, she had a HIPAA violation. She called the mother without the patient's permission. For another thing, she was using scare tactics against the patient, saying, you know, you could die, which is really not necessary when we're getting informed refusal of care from a patient. So there were several things that she did that could have been done better. She could have established a better relationship with the patient. And so let's talk a little bit more about how we can do a better job than this when we have a patient who leaves against medical advice. So every patient who comes to us should give their informed consent for treatment in one of several ways. One is the express granting of authority to render treatment. So in your department, as in mine, when patients come in, they sign a consent for treatment form. And whether they choose to read all the elements of that is another story. But they do grant their authority to render treatment. And by the fact that someone has called 911, got in the ambulance, and came to us, that also is implied consent to treatment, derived from the conduct of the involved parties. So if we go into a patient and say, okay, it's time to draw your blood now to do your blood work, they hold their arm out. By their behavior, they are consenting to the proposed intervention. And the last is consent implied in law, which refers to the emergency treatment for patients who are unable to give consent. So this applies to all of our John Doe patients that we don't know who they are, they were in an MVA, they're unresponsive. We render care in an emergency situation based on what a reasonable person would want in that circumstance. So when someone wants to refuse care, the same elements apply as when someone consents to a procedure or intervention. The patient has to have the capacity to consent or refuse care. We have to deliver the appropriate information so that they can make their decision. The patient has to be acting voluntarily, not under any form of coercion. And last but not least, interestingly, documentation is not a legally required element of informed consent or refusal of care. However, of course, it would be in our best judgment to document those elements. And at the very end, we'll talk about how to construct the ideal AMA note. So, well, what should we talk about when we talk to a patient about their informed consent for what we would like to do? They should know what their diagnosis is. They should know what we're proposing to do if we're proposing a procedure or admission to the hospital. They should know the risks and consequences of what we're proposing, how likely it is to be successful, what are some feasible alternatives, and what is the prognosis with and without their consent for what we are proposing. So there are basically two standards for disclosure of information. So let's say we want to do an LP on someone. Do we have to list every possible complication that could result from this? Well, the professional standard would say that we should disclose to the patient everything that a physician knows about this procedure and possible complications. But most courts recognize the reasonable person standard, which means you don't have to say everything under the sun that could happen. But what would a reasonable person want to know? What is germane to a reasonable person in this circumstance? So in the ED, we have some obstacles compared to the office-based physician who has plenty of time and a relationship with the patient. We don't usually have any pre-existing relationship with the patient. Of course, we're under time constraints every day. The patients came to us They didn't know who we are. They didn't know. They often didn't even choose the facility. And we are very busy in a typical shift trying to save lives. And when a patient wants to sign out against medical advice, we all know this can be a fairly large time sink. So there are some times when the patient does not have the legal authority to give informed consent. One time we mentioned, well, implied consent. The other time is emergencies, and the other time is public health emergencies. So, for example, if a patient has tuberculosis, they may not be able to refuse care because of public health standards. So what information should we give to the patient? We should describe the intervention that we want to do, how it will benefit the patient, what the risks are, alternatives, and if you think it's appropriate or germane to the conversation, what the experience of the healthcare team is, and if it's germane to the patient, they may be interested in knowing some financial considerations as well. So when a patient wants to refuse medical care, sometimes, and I've seen many nurses do this, they come to me and say, oh, the patient in room 12 already left AMA and they signed the form and here it is. And I'm extremely disappointed when I hear that because a signature on a paper does not constitute an appropriate refusal of medical care. It is the process of refusing medical care that constitutes against medical advice. So the first thing we always have to do is determine whether the patient has the capacity to refuse medical care. We have to make sure to do our job to deliver the appropriate information that we discussed. We want to provide the best medical care that we can. And so if a patient wants to leave AMA, that doesn't mean we have to pull the IV and stop the fluids and antibiotics. We still want to provide whatever medical care the patient is going to consent to. And last but not least, documenting it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So patient autonomy, we talked about that. And that just refers to the patient's job is that they know their goals and objectives of medical therapy better than we do. We may have more training in the medical realm, but they have more knowledge about what they want for their body. In America, we believe that patients are free to choose between different choices. So the question comes up sometimes, well, then how do we ever have the right to detain someone against their will? When someone is drunk and wants to leave, should we respect their autonomy and allow them to leave? Well, I want to share with you a quote from a friend of mine on the ASAP Ethics Committee, Greg Larkin, who said, in fact, the best way to respect patient autonomy is to take good care of the patient in order to restore their full decisional capacity and hence their autonomy as soon as possible. So when a patient is intoxicated and potentially of danger to themselves, by detaining them until they are sober, we're actually helping to restore their decisional capacity and autonomy as soon as possible. So what happens when patients leave against medical advice? They actually have, as a group of patients, higher mortality rates, higher rates of future admissions, and higher use of the healthcare system in the future. These patients often are males, younger. They often have a history of alcohol or substance abuse. They may lack medical insurance or primary medical care. And once they've signed out against medical advice, they're at high risk of doing it again. So if you read that in the chart, a patient who has signed out against medical advice before has a higher likelihood of doing it again. And these patients have more comorbidities than their cohorts as well. So the AHRQ hospital database has a list of diagnoses of patients who leave against medical advice. And this is sobering. We're not too surprised to see that there are psychiatric problems and substance abuse problems here. But these patients also commonly have chest pain, pneumonia, diabetes, CHF, asthma, the diagnosis where we really don't want the patient to sign out against medical advice, but these are the top diagnoses of patients who leave AMA. So why do people leave AMA? When we ask them, here's a study that showed common reasons for leaving against medical advice. Patients sometimes may not trust the particular physician or the institution. There may be a substance related dependence. There may be a psychiatric diagnosis. Patients may be afraid of what they're going to hear or what's going to happen to them in the hospital. They may be concerned about their bill and how much this is running up. They may have a family emergency. Interestingly, reconciliation with significant others is a reason to leave AMA. Often there are legal issues such as a court date, and most frustrating of all is when a patient says, I just want to go. They won't give us a specific reason. It's very challenging to work with a patient who can't give us a reason why they want to leave against medical advice. So to determine capacity, we're just going to talk about this briefly and then talk about how we're going to procedurally go through allowing a patient to sign out against medical advice. So to have capacity, a patient has to have the ability to receive and understand information. They have to be able to deliberate and have to be able to make and express their choice. So capacity is not all or nothing, that once someone has been determined to lack capacity, they then lack decisional capacity the rest of their lives. And it is dynamic and may fluctuate depending on whether a patient is in pain, whether they are anxious, whether they've been taking their medications, whether they are intoxicated. So when we determine capacity on each and every patient we see, whether you do it as an official process or not. By routinely communicating with your patients, you are assessing their capacity. And usually, patients answer our questions. We have an interaction. We have a logical and rational conversation. We describe a therapeutic plan. The patient cooperates. And we determine from that they have the capacity to participate in medical decision-making. Sometimes when capacity is in question, we may need to do some more detailed questions of cognition, of their orientation, of their understanding of the process. And there are also cases where we may also want to do a standardized test, such as the mini mental status exam. This you can get on your smartphone and just have it handy if you'd like to use it. You can also just do a Google search for a mini mental status examination. It's a 5-minute, very easy to administer standardized test that on occasion may be a helpful adjunct to determining whether the patient has capacity. So what patients do we need to be concerned about who may lack capacity? We would be concerned about patients who have limited intellect, patients who are delirious for any reason, medical or intoxication, patients who are in significant amount of pain, who are anxious, confused, depressed, or who are using any pharmaceutical or illicit substance. So here are some of the mistakes that we wouldn't want to happen to us when we are dealing with a patient about their capacity. We wouldn't want to presume that capacity is all or nothing. As we mentioned, it depends on the scenario and the patient's state of mind at that particular time. We wouldn't want to presume that legal competence is the same as medical decision-making capacity. There are some patients who have legally turned over their affairs to a family member, but they may still be awake and alert and able to participate in medical decisions. Again, we talked about capacity is not necessarily consistent over time, and a patient who lacks capacity one day from alcohol intoxication may be totally fine the next day to participate in their medical decisions. The alcohol level predicts competence. That is a false statement. The alcohol level in and of itself does not determine decisional capacity. It is one tool that we may use, but we still need to use physician judgment to determine whether the patient has the appropriate decisional capacity. Here is another pitfall to think, I only need to assess capacity if the patient refuses treatment. That, in fact, is false, because if a patient agrees with our treatment, we still need to make sure that they have the capacity to consent to treatment that we're rendering. Here's another pitfall to think that psych patients aren't competent. Psychiatric patients may actually be totally fine to participate in medical decision making, and again, we need to assess their capacity. Some people may think that I need to get a psychiatrist to determine if the patient has capacity. A psychiatrist might be helpful if available, but it is not required to determine whether the patient has capacity. Some people erroneously think that minors can't consent or refuse care. And depending on your state, all states have an emancipated minor provision. Many states also have a mature minor provision where patients who are 14 or older can participate in medical decision making if they are mature enough to understand the ramifications of their decision. And the worst mistake of all would be to say, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, therefore you must do what I say. That would be the biggest mistake. Okay, we have another video clip that we're going to watch here. And the question that we're looking for in this video is, did the HIV positive patient have adequate decisional capacity? So I'm going to give you a little introduction because it's a fast-moving video. So there's a patient who is HIV positive, has had AIDS for some period of time. He sustains a gunshot wound to the abdomen, comes into the emergency department. The surgeon wants to take him to the operating room, and he wants to refuse surgery. So let's watch and see, and we're going to take a vote whether you think this patient had adequate decisional capacity to refuse surgery.
Sir? Sir, I'm Officer Napolitano. You told the officer on site that your assailant was Caucasian?
Yes, right.
Did he wear a yellow windbreaker?
Yellow. How did you know that?
I think he might have shot some people at a foster care facility 2 blocks away.
The same guy?
And three.
Can you remember your license plate number? No.
Pressure's down to 90.
2-liter saline wide open.
But it's a black Acura Legend, correct?
What's wrong?
You know what? You're going to have to do this later. Check with DMV.
You might be bleeding in your abdomen.
You know for sure.
All right, let's get an ultrasound.
Pressure's up to 120 after 2 liters.
You need this?
No. Liver and spleen are intact.
So maybe I'm not bleeding.
No, you've got a slow leak from a small vessel. You're going to need surgery.
I don't want surgery.
Well, you know, look, we'll make a midline incision, we'll find a bleeding artery, and then we'll tie it off.
Doc, I'm already dying.
Your infection might slow your recovery, but it's routine surgery. People live with HIV.
I know that. I've been fighting this disease since 1986. I responded to the AZT, and the protease inhibitors were a miracle. They gave me an extra 5 years. But my T cells have been dropping since July. My viral load's gone right through the roof, even with all these antivirals.
Mr. Jeffries, I need your consent.
No. I had pneumocystis 3 months ago.
If we don't operate, you'll die.
I am already dead, Doc. This may just allow me to skip a very painful end.
Run in another liter of saline. Any chest pain or dizziness?
No.
All right, let's get 2 units from the blood bank and transfuse each over an hour.
No, I don't want a blood transfusion.
Your hematocrit is drifting to a dangerously low level.
I understand. No. Thank you.
What about your family? I mean, if you don't care about yourself, what about them?
I haven't spoken to my mother in over 30 years. I outlived the 2 people that I loved in the world. I've lived longer than I expected. Just let me go. I'm ready.
Spinal injury is incomplete. We can operate.
I need an emergency signature.
Not now, Peter.
IJ's in. Let's get another chest.
He's bleeding out.
Run the Solumedrol 325 an hour.
Gunshot wound to the belly. He's hypertensive and all.
Yeah. Whatever. Go.
Systolic's up to 100.
All right. Let's get him off. Can you get a repeat CBC?
Whatever you want, Peter.
I've got my 2 signatures.
He made himself clear.
Look, he has advanced AIDS. He probably has an HIV encephalopathy.
No, he was alert and oriented. He should have called psych.
I did. They never showed up.
Okay, so the surgeon's taking the patient to the operating room. So what do you think? Did the HIV-positive patient have adequate decisional capacity? Raise your hand if you thought he had adequate capacity to refuse. So that's almost everyone. Anyone question that? Anyone think he should go to surgery? So we're almost unanimous on that. So ideally, we might want to ask a few more questions to ascertain his decisional capacity. And actually, I might have questioned it when he first arrived. When he first arrived, he seemed a little confused, wasn't able to answer questions, was hypotensive. But certainly by the time of the detailed conversation, he explained very rationally all the reasons for refusing surgery and refusing a blood transfusion. So the fact that he had HIV did not render him lacking in decisional capacity. So what do we do when we have a patient who does have impaired capacity? Well, we need to think about how we're going to best manage this case. So if a patient doesn't have capacity, we'd like to identify if they have any documents that would help us out. Sometimes an advance directive will help us out. Sometimes even if it's not an arrest situation, if we can identify a power of attorney, that would be very helpful in a patient who does not have capacity. If not, we might involve a surrogate decision maker. Every state has a list of surrogates, of a hierarchy of surrogates. In most states, it's the spouse who would be considered the next of kin to speak for the patient, an adult child, or a parent. So we'd like to identify someone who could speak for the patient. If we know what the patient's values were before they became to lack capacity, and this would apply in the case we talked about earlier, we'd like to honor those patient-centered values. And there are cases where we don't have any of that information available. We should act in the best interest of the patient based on what a reasonable person would want in a similar circumstance. So in some cases, when a patient wants to leave against medical advice, it may be very helpful to negotiate with the patient. We may want to take some time to sit down with them and establish trust with them and say, I'd like to decide together what is best to do for you. We might want to make some negotiations such as what else we could do in the emergency department to help you feel better before you go. Maybe we could admit you just overnight instead of a long hospital stay. Are there other things we could do as an outpatient that would help you even though you need to leave today? And is there anyone we could call to help you in this circumstance? Would you like to call any family members, clergy, or have a social worker come in to talk to you? How could we best work this scenario out to help you? And in many cases, that will be helpful in deriving the best case scenario for the patient. So if the patient is not able to participate in medical decision-making and we get a surrogate involved, it's important to remember that the surrogate should be speaking for the patient, not for themselves. And so sometimes, say, for example, a daughter may come in to speak for her mother who has dementia and is in a nursing home, and she says, well, I want everything done for the patient. So it's important to redirect that discussion to, we want to understand what would the patient have wanted in this circumstance. Did she write anything down? Did she talk to you about this? Do you know what her wishes would be in this circumstance? And so advanced directives, all surrogate decision makers and physicians should honor advanced directives if we know about them. So here's a question. Will insurance reimburse encounters if a patient signs out against medical advice? I've heard many people say this. Sometimes I overhear walking by, the nurse will say, well, if you leave AMA, insurance isn't going to cover it. So how many people think this is a true statement? Insurance will not reimburse encounters. So, and how many people think that's false? So most people think that's false. You're absolutely right. That is false. If you hear anybody saying that, you can correct them. That leaving against medical advice does not preclude insurance company. And I checked with several different insurance companies in our state about this and verified. They said, well, why wouldn't we pay? The services have been rendered. Now, I don't know where this myth got started, but it may be that some insurance companies, if a patient leaves against medical advice and has a subsequent poor outcome related to them leaving against medical advice, the insurance company may use that as an indication to not pay or not pay completely in the future. The patient may be asked to bear some responsibility for the future. But for our intents and purposes in the emergency department, if services were rendered, insurance will pay for it. And in fact, saying a statement like that to a patient could be considered a form of coercion. So we really want to avoid making threatening or using scare tactics to tell the patient, well, if you leave, you're going to be responsible for the bill. Not true. So when a patient wants to leave against medical advice, our documentation is very important. We talked about how it's not a legally required portion of against medical advice, but certainly it would protect the patient by having a valid medical record, and it would protect us if there's any medical legal ramifications in the future. So an AMA documentation should have the signature of both the patient and the physician, of course the date and time, what the medical condition is, what the risks are of leaving against medical advice. It should include our assessment of the patient's capacity and that the patient understood the proposed treatment and risks of refusal and what follow-up instructions we're giving. Now, some of my residents have occasionally made the mistake of saying, well, the patient's leaving AMA, so I don't do any discharge instructions, right? That's not true at all. If a patient's leaving against medical advice, I would say, if anything, it's more important than ever to have adequate discharge instructions, to make sure the patient feels welcome to come back if they change their mind, make sure that we've adequately treated their condition as best we can, even though they're leaving against medical advice. So here's an example of an AMA documentation. We could say that Mr. So-and-so left against medical advice. I assessed that he had the appropriate decisional capacity. I explained the risks and benefits of the therapy that I recommend, which is whatever, hospitalization, IV fluids, whatever, and alternatives, including whatever they are. The patient understands and accepts these risks and chooses to leave against medical advice, and I invited him to return at any time if he chooses to undergo further treatment. So that would be a good example of an AMA documentation. So we have a few cases we can talk about to illustrate some of the things that we've talked about. We have four cases we can talk about, and we probably have time for a couple of them. And so I'm going to ask you to choose one. Do you want to talk about a 24-year-old pregnant patient with vaginal bleeding, the case we introduced with today, the 76-year-old female with end-stage COPD, a 37-year-old female intoxicated with a forehead laceration, or a 35-year-old male with AIDS, fever, cough, and dyspnea? All these patients wanted to leave AMA. Anyone want to choose a case?
Number three.
Okay, number three. Let's talk about this. So I'm guessing the reason you chose case number 3 is you've probably seen this case or something very similar to it. We all have the intoxicated patient who wants to leave AMA. So in this case, we have a 37-year-old intoxicated female who has a forehead laceration. She's refusing sutures and requests discharge. So what things might we want to think about in this case? First of all, we would want to think about the patient's capacity. Absolutely crucial before we make a decision about whether she can leave against medical advice. So we need to do a better mental status examination to determine her capacity. Other things we might consider using in determining capacity are a standardized test like the mini mental status exam or an alcohol level. Now, an alcohol level in and of itself does not determine patient capacity, but is one tool that we might use. So in this particular case, when I saw this patient, I gave her a choice. I said, we need to determine whether you are competent to leave against medical advice. And if you are, by all means, you can leave against medical advice. We're not going to hold you. But we need to make that determination. So we could either do a 5-minute test of your thinking skills, or we could get an alcohol level and decide together whether you can leave or whether you need to stay until you sober up. So she said, well, I'll get the alcohol level. So fortunately for me, her alcohol level was very high. It was 200. And so then I told her, well, you need to stay until you're sober. And then if you're sober and you want to leave, by all means, you can. So she agreed to the sutures. We found a sober ride, and she was we were able to complete her medical care and send her home with a sober ride. So the important thing about this case is we need to assess capacity in all patients. If a patient's leaving against medical advice, especially crucial to assess their capacity and provide the best possible medical care that the patient will accept. And did you have a question?
Yeah, suppose if she still refuses to go, what would you do?
So if she was still insistent on leaving, even though we now have very good evidence that she lacks capacity, it would be very appropriate to detain a patient like this until they are sober to make a decision. So if a patient lacks capacity and wants to leave against medical advice, it would be the best treatment for us to give to detain them until they are able to make an appropriate decision. All right, so let's go back and choose another case. Anyone want to choose another case to talk about? Okay, case 1. This is a very interesting case. A 24-year-old pregnant patient, she's about 7 months pregnant, so the fetus is definitely of age of viability. She was brought in by EMS for vaginal bleeding, and the EMS providers told us that she had a history of psych. That's all they knew, psych. We didn't have any details about what was the psychiatric disturbance. Is she compliant? We knew nothing else about it. So the vaginal bleeding was significant. The paramedics described that at the scene she was wearing sweatpants that were soaked through with blood, and they helped her change before coming to the emergency department. So this is not a minor thing. This is a serious threat to both the mother and the unborn child. She was hemodynamically stable, and as soon as the paramedics rolled her into the room, as soon as she got in, she got up off the stretcher and said, I'm leaving. So we have a very tough decision to make here because this patient is about to leave, and we really have not done an adequate assessment of decisional capacity. So in this case, this was a good example of where we had to negotiate with the patient one step at a time. So rather than jump on the patient and say, well, we're going to restrain you, security come in, 4-point restraints, rather than do that and totally eliminate any hope of a physician-patient relationship, I spoke with the patient and I said, let's stay for a few minutes and make sure that you and the baby are okay. How about if you stay for a few minutes, let us check your vital signs, let us draw some blood work, and if everything's okay and you want to go, by all means, that would be fine. You can go. So she agreed to that. Basically, every 5 or 10 minutes, she had 1 foot out the door, and I was in the room all night negotiating with her one step at a time about what to do. How about staying a little bit longer so we can check another blood pressure and make sure it's okay? Eventually, she did agree to be admitted to the hospital, and she had a C-section the next day, and both she and the baby did fine. But there are times when there is no single recipe for success for patients who want to leave against medical advice, and you may need to use your best judgment about how can I work together with this individual patient to arrive at a shared decision-making plan that's going to be acceptable to both of us. Now, we all know that that doesn't work in every case, and no matter how hard you try to be rational and reasonable, there are some people who are not going to be reasonable, and it's not going to be possible to come to shared decision-making. So the keys in cases of against medical advice are, as we spoke about, we want to assess capacity, deliver information, do our best to negotiate and come up with a shared decision-making plan, and if all else fails, if the patient has the appropriate capacity, they can sign out against medical advice. So let's do one more case. Anyone want to choose? Okay, so that's a good question. What about the fact that she's pregnant and there's another human being involved? Does she have the right to sign out against medical advice when she is endangering the life of another person? That's an excellent question, and the answer to that question might depend whether you are looking for the moral answer to the question or the legal answer to the question. So in the state of Ohio, where I live, an unborn child is not considered a human being with rights until the patient is delivered. So before, even though the unborn child is, 32 weeks and probably viable, in Ohio that child doesn't have any rights until the child is born. So in Ohio, a mother has the right to make decisions about her own body, even if it jeopardizes the life of the fetus. Now, morally and ethically, we may think differently about that because certainly her actions to leave AMA do affect their unborn child, which is why we really bent over backwards to accommodate this patient and tried every means possible to get her to stay. But that's an excellent question. Okay, one last case. Anyone want to choose? Okay, let's talk about four. We'd already talked about two a little bit. And then we'll be able to end a little bit early today. So this is a 35-year-old male who has AIDS. He comes in with fever, cough, chest pain, and dyspnea. He also has weight loss, fatigue, forgetfulness, and he's refusing antibiotics. He just wants something for pain and something for anxiety. And his friend is saying, well, this is ridiculous. You've been so sick all week. You've been in bed with this fever, not feeling good, not eating. You need treatment. But the patient is saying, nope, I only want pain medication and anxiolytics. So what kind of things might we want to think about in this case? Well, this patient is obviously ill. Ideally, we probably would want to give antibiotics. We're thinking about things like pneumocystis or bacterial pneumonia, other possible diagnoses. So we'd like to do some tests. We'd probably like to do some blood work, a chest x-ray, possibly admit the patient depending on what his vital signs, pulse ox, chest x-ray show. But he only wants something for pain and anxiety. So key in a case like this would be determining capacity. We would want to do some assessment of capacity. And there's several potential threats to capacity here. If he has fever and is systemically ill, he may have some element of delirium. We would want to assess his oxygenation. And he also is at risk for HIV encephalopathy. So we would want to do a careful assessment of his capacity by asking questions, having a conversation with him, determining his orientation and cognition. And if necessary, we may want to use a standardized test such as the mini-mental as well. If the patient has decisional capacity, we would then want to have a discussion with the patient about what we're proposing and why and what the risks are to him of refusing this. We would want to make sure that he understands that he has a potentially life-threatening condition and that if he refuses intervention, he should have all that information at his fingertips. So, and we may also, if the patient consents, we might want to have a discussion with the patient and his friend. So we don't want to commit a HIPAA violation, but I would ask the patient, is it okay if we talk about all of the ramifications of your illness with your friend in the room? And then we would want to hopefully negotiate together to come up with a plan that the patient will find acceptable. We might want to ask the patient, why is it that you don't want any other testing or antibiotics? He may be actually feeling depressed and suicidal, which very much changes the situation. He may feel that he's seeing his doctor tomorrow and he just wants something to sleep tonight, which is very different. So asking the patient why he wants to leave, why he doesn't want antibiotics, is crucial to understanding his perspective and his decisional capacity. So in this particular case, with some patient education and negotiation, the patient did consent to having a workup and ultimately got admitted for treatment for pneumonia. So conclusions in this case, we would, of course, want to assess capacity for all patients, honor patient goals and values, and provide the best possible medical care that the patient will accept. So let's say the scenario were a little bit different and the patient said, I don't want any of that today. I'm so sick of needles. I'm so sick of x-rays. I just want something. I'm so tired. I just want to get home and get to sleep. Could you please just give me something to sleep? I want to get out of here. In a case like that, we might want to, if the patient is absolutely refusing anything and has decisional capacity, we might want to arrange an outpatient visit within the next 24 hours. Or if we might want to say, well, how about a chest x-ray? If we find something on that that indicates a possible bacterial infection, how about if I just give you antibiotics, a prescription for antibiotics, even though that's not what I recommend as first-line treatment, we would want to give the best medical care that the patient will agree to having. So, in conclusion, in all of our patients that we see, we should assess their decisional capacity. We want to build a trusting relationship with patients. We want to provide all the information that the patient can make the best decision, including the risks, benefits, alternatives to the therapy, and provide the best possible medical care and document those essential elements. And thank you very much for coming and have a nice evening.